This is a case study on a patient that we were asked to see in the emergency room. And I'm going to present this patient to you, and then later on I'm going to give you the outcome. So that's to follow. Miss Smith, and that literally was her name, and I probably shouldn't use it, was a 70-year-old morbidly obese. And by morbidly obese in Tennessee, we mean obese. This lady was 5'2 and weighed 280 pounds. Now that your BMI is over 40. That's morbidly obese. With a history of coronary artery disease, ischemic heart disease, type 2 diabetes, she presented to the ER with a 3-day history of nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, fever, sweats, chills, rigors. Okay, so our index of suspicion is we're there. I mean, you know, we think she has an intra-abdominal source of infection. On physical exam, her blood pressure was 90 over 54, and you're going to hear me say you absolutely have to know what your patient's baseline blood pressures are so you can make some clinical assessments about the patient so you can move on with your treatment and resuscitation. Her temp was 100.6. Her respiratory rate was a little bit elevated at 18. Her heart rate was 50. Should have been higher. Okay? But she was awake and alert, but her O2 sat was only 91% on 5 liters per minute. Now, you and I, when we breathe, this air in this room is 21% oxygen. We're virtually 95% or above saturated. So this tells me that she is not oxygenating herself well, and she's got what's called an increased AA gradient, alveolar arteriolar gradient. Her abdomen was, I mean, it was just huge. And in the obese patients, it's hard to get a good abdominal exam. But she had rare bowel sounds. She was diffusely tender all over when we pushed on her. She had no rebound or guarding, which are peritoneal signs that let you know that there's peritoneal inflammation, and you better move on it because this might be a surgical catastrophe that you need to get to the OR. Next. Now, here's where you guys help us. When we drew our sepsis panel, her sodium was 132, potassium is 4.5, chloride's 97. I'm going to read the important abnormals. The BUN was 40, creatinine's 3.7. She's in acute renal failure when she hits a door, okay? Or she has chronic renal insufficiency. She's got a leukocytosis, white count of 18,600. And for some reason, she's anemic. She has a hemoglobin of 9.6. Her platelet count's surprisingly normal. Her lactic acid, I would have predicted, would have been high. Lactic acid, as you well know, is an indicator of global perfusion. Her free ionized calcium, and I will ask you to see a show of hands in a minute, was low at 1.12. Does anybody in this room know why we're looking at free ionized calcium now, right on admission? You guys are lab people, do you know? Okay. It's okay. All right. We always look at it routinely because if this patient goes on to develops a local infection that becomes a systemic infection, which is what sepsis is, if they do not respond to fluids, crystalloid or colloid, this patient is going to end up on vasopressors. And your catecholamine-like vasopressors, norepinephrine, dopamine, which you should never use, or phenylephrine, neosinephrine, all require calcium to be in adequate levels in the serum so that you can vasoconstrict your peripheral vasculature. Okay? So we see that she's hypocalcemic. All right? The biologically active form of calcium, free ionized calcium. And we gave you the normals there. She didn't have a coagulopathy. Her PT and PTT were okay. Her cortisol levels were elevated appropriately, okay? And you'll hear me discuss why later. And her procalcitonin level on admission was markedly elevated at 43 nanograms per ml. Now notice, she has a markedly elevated procalcitonin levels, but a normal lactic acid level. And we'll talk about this later, okay? Her medications prior to coming in, clonidine, metoprolol, verapamil, those are all antihypertensives or cardiac drugs, okay? And And that's important to know. When we went back and looked at her medical record, her usual pressure ran about 180 on those three medications. Now we're down to 90 systolic. Okay, and on Humulin N, next. So, what was our initial impression of this lady? We thought she had a severe intra-abdominal infection. We didn't know what it was within the abdomen. But we know the patient was hypotensive, and we knew that the patient needed to be resuscitated. And we're going to tell you about early goal-directed therapy, and I think your next speaker will mention it too. But we put her on the resuscitation sepsis bundle, which is a protocol of about a 5-page order set, and we put in a central line as soon as we were asked to see her, and we began our resuscitation. We ordered set antibiotics and antifungals. We cultured her from stem to stern, blood, urine, sputum, and any other thing that we felt was appropriate. We put her on Zosyn, Cipro, and Fluconazole IV stat. And we also felt, as we mentioned before, that she presented with acute renal failure. We felt that was due to severe sepsis with ATN, secondary to intravascular volume depletion. And we also thought she was hypocalcemic. So we replaced her calcium with a calcium gluconate drip. And the PharmDs handle that for us. We order it. They make sure it comes up stat, and we give it. Next. Now, with that in mind, let's talk about sepsis and septic shock and why it is such a problem in this country. Demographically, we're all getting older. The baby booms are moving towards retirement age. We're doing a better job of keeping older folks with chronic medical problems alive. So we're going to see sepsis and the incidence of sepsis and the incidence of septic shock increasing. It's a huge problem. We don't do a good job of initially identifying it early enough. It has a terrible mortality. The length of stays are too long. The costs are too high. I think you heard Herb this morning say that the cost of medical care in this country is now 20% of the GDP. We can't afford it. It's going to break the system. If you look at most European countries, they're down less than 12%. 4 years ago when I did my MBA, percentage of health care's cost of the GDP was 16%. It's risen 4% in the last 4 years, a percent a year. It's going to break the bank. Who pays for health care in this country? Government and industry. And government and industry is saying to us, with this particular problem, doctors and nurses, you're doing a poor job. And we are. And we want more bang for our buck. And what are we? And we're going to have to provide it, because what are they going to do? They're going to measure outcomes. And they're measuring it already. And it's going to be pay for performance. They're going to direct patients. And we already have in East Tennessee, and we're the cow's tail on everything. But in East Tennessee, we already have initiative among local industry there looking at these outcomes, because they want to identify what hospitals, what healthcare organizations provide the best care for a particular problem, so they can direct their employees to that service. And I'm sure Kaiser and the other players out here are way ahead of us on that. But sepsis is a leading cause of death in the USA. 750,000 new cases per year. 215,000 deaths per year. Now, when we look at some of the other leading causes of death, you're going to be astounded. It costs, and I think another presenter already told us this morning that it costs about $17 billion a year. But I want to tell you a little bit more. That's not the whole story. Virtually all of these patients end up in somebody's ICU on a ventilator. Now, you could have a few patients who have sepsis, septic shock, that don't end up on a ventilator. What you need to know as laboratory folks is, what is it costing your institution to take care of these patients? Here's what it's costing. The average cost per case of sepsis, $35,000. But I'm here to tell you, I think it's even more. Because in our, across, you take all hospitals across the country, average cost per day, and this is true cost, not what we charge the patient, non-ventilated patient, $7,000 a day, ICU. Okay? $7,000 a day. What do you think it costs to take care of a ventilated patient who is much sicker? About $18,000 to $20,000 a day. We've got to find any way we can to lengthen, to decrease the length of stays on those ventilators and decrease the length of stay in the ICU. We can't afford it. Next. Okay. I've already mentioned that we're under the gun scrutiny of government and private payers of health care and corporations in this country to improve on what we're doing with these patients. How we're taking care of these patients, our outcomes are poor at best, and they're not improving. The mortality is unacceptably high. We're going to show you the numbers in a minute. Next. All right, here's the bad news, the good, bad, and the ugly. It's all just bad and ugly. You're going to hear me define some terms for you, and I want you to be aware of them, because this is the way we organize our thinking as practitioners and the way we strategically approach these patients to try to get them through their critical illness. Critical care physician has two jobs. One, identify the life-threatening problem or problems from the most life-threatening to the least. Identify the cause of them, eradicate and eliminate the causes. Two, support the patient until you're able to do number one. That means prevent organ system failure. How do we do with the SIRS? SIRS is systemic inflammatory response. You don't have to write this down. It's all in your handout. I'm going to define it for you in a minute. 7% of all patients that have SIRS die. You're going to hear me say later on that all sepsis is SIRS, but not all SIRS is sepsis. People that have sepsis, 16% of those people die. People that have severe sepsis, 20% of those patients die. But people that go into septic shock, and we're going to define shock for you, virtually half of, one out of two die. Okay? Now, if we saw these kind of rates with acute heart disease or acute stroke, there'd be a revolt. Now, this is just to give us an idea of how sepsis stacks up. Everybody knows about cancer. Everybody knows about a heart disease. Everybody knows about stroke, but everybody doesn't know about sepsis. These are statistics from a paper by Angus and Minio. These are the numbers per year in the U.S. 215,000 cases of severe sepsis deaths in the U.S., acute MI, which they now call acute coronary syndrome, 193,000. Lung cancer, 156,000. Colon cancer, 57,000. Breast cancer, 42,000. What does that tell us? That tells us we've done a better job with coronary artery disease, with ischemic heart disease. We've dropped the death rates on them. We've not dented this, okay? Cancer, still is a huge killer, but we're making progress. So let's define the terms so you'll understand how doctors at the bedside try to organize their thinking. So and the amount of information is tremendous, and it's hard to get your hands around it, your arms around it. So we want to define some terms for you. The first term we want to define for you is systemic inflammatory response syndrome. Okay. That's a response to an insult or an injury independent of cause where you manifest more than one of the following. Now, what you're going to hear me talk about is there are going to be general variables and there's going to be specific variables. But if you have an inflammatory response from whatever cause, your temperature you'll either be hyperthermic with a temp greater than 100.4 or you'll be hypothermic with a temp greater than less than that should be less than 96.8, okay? That's a typo. That's wrong. If you were infected today, would you rather have a fever or would you rather your temperature be low? Yeah, it's always better to mount a fever. If we see a patient that we think is infected and the infection spread body-wide in the form of inflammatory response and they're hypothermic, those patients don't do well. They're much more likely to die than a patient that mounts fever. We always learned in medical school that tachycardia was a heart rate greater than 100. I'm telling you, it's a heart rate greater than 90. You better start worrying. This lady didn't manifest that heart rate greater than 90 because she was on a calcium channel blocker in the form of verapamil, which slows your heart rate, and also on metoprolol, which is a beta blocker, also slows your heart rate. If you're tachypneic, if your respiratory rate's greater than 20 per minute, you're in distress. If we look at a blood gas and your PCO2 is less than 32, that means that you're blowing off PCO2. That goes along with tachypnea, with increased respiratory rate. If we see a leukocytosis with a count greater than 12,000, or a leukopenia with a count less than 4,000, or we see early forms on your white cells, more than 10% bands, then we need to be thinking about inflammation infection. Next. Sepsis is a documented or suspected infection. Remember that. Infection. Not all SIRS is infection. Okay? That has one or more of the following. The general variables, we've already mentioned hyperhypothermia. I won't go over that again. Tachypnea. Altered mental status. The patient's becoming confused. Okay? They're not thinking clearly. Or in the last 24 hours, you've had to try, in order to try to maintain an adequate blood pressure, you've kept putting more and more volume. Isotonic crystalloid in this patient, or colloid, more than 20 mLs per kilogram over the last 24 hours. You better be thinking about systemic inflammatory response with capillary leak due to endothelial damage. Now, the other thing that you're going to see is a metabolic alteration can be hyperglycemia with glucose is greater than 120 milligrams per cent in the absence of diabetes. This lady had type 2 diabetes, so we really couldn't hang that on her. Next. Okay, there's the inflammatory variables. We've already talked about them. But we also want to talk about some of the biomarkers that we may be looking at in sepsis and septic shock. And those are the plasma C-reactive protein, which may be greater than 2 standard deviations above normal. Now, in our lab, back in Tennessee, we measure both high-sensitivity CRP, so we get an actual number, and then we do the screening test where we get 1 plus, 2 plus, 3 plus, 4 plus. You guys know more about that than I do, but usually I order high-sensitivity CRP because I want to see how much inflammation we have going on. And the thing that we really want to clue you in today is a new biomarker that we're going to strategically employ to try to make earlier diagnosis of bacterial and fungal infection, and that's procalcitonins. When we see those levels, 2 standard deviations above normal, we need to be thinking about infection body-wide. Okay? And we're going to, all right. Now, there are other markers that we look at in our patients. Remember, I said we put central lines in these patients to resuscitate them. One thing we do is we draw arterial blood gases come from arteries. We draw mixed venous blood gases, which come from the distal port of the central line that we put in. Should be about 2 centimeters above the right atrium. If we see a saturation greater than 75%, a normal mixed venous blood gas is 70 to 75%, okay? If we see it above that 75%, then we start wondering, okay, our patient is not utilizing oxygen at the peripheral tissue level. It's being shunted intracellularly. Cellular machinery is not working. When we see that, we know we're in trouble. We know our patient's in trouble, and it's a bad prognostic sign. If we're able to measure our cardiac indexes, and there's a couple of ways of doing that, and I'm going to mention them just now, and our cardiac indexes are greater than 3.5 liters per minute per meter square, we realize that we're probably looking at a hyperdynamic state. That means a high-output vasodilatory capillary leak inflammation going on body-wide. Now, How can we get this cardiac indexes? A couple of ways that we look at it. You can either put in a Swan-Ganz catheter, and I know that that's fallen out of vogue and out of fashion, but there are still patients that I find that about 6 or 8 patients a year I'll have that I know they're in front of me and they have shock. And in order for me to categorize that shock, I've got to know what their hemodynamic profile looks like. And I can't lay my hands on them and put my stethoscope on them in order, no imaging study to be able to tell that. I have to measure their hemodynamics. And the way I do that is with a Swan-Ganz catheter and an art line. Okay? Now, we've had some advanced technology where we can get that cardiac index without putting the catheter down and through the right heart. Anybody here know, has hospitals are using FloTrax? FloTrax are non-invasive devices that you hook up to your art line that are able to give you a continuous cardiac output, cardiac index, and mixed venous O2 if you want it right off the art line. It's pretty amazing technology. Next. So I'm a simple guy. I've got to keep it simple for me and my patients so I can know what I'm looking at. What is sepsis? Sepsis is just SIRS with infection. Now let's stop here right for a minute. When I had residents and interns, one of the first things I do when I'm around with them in the ICU is I'd look at them and I'd say, what's an infection? Well, you know, you just get this, oh, we know what an infection is. Tell me. Well, you know, if something bad happens to a patient. Oh, yeah, no kidding. But even when you would talk to other, and it was a funny phenomenon because, you know, I would not tell them. I'd make them go look it up. But they'd go ask other attendings. And the attendings and other physicians would say, they could not in turn answer the residents and interns' question, what is an infection? An infection simply is invasion of normally sterile tissue by a microorganism. And then, as you heard Dr. Fowler say this morning, the host response to that invasion. So you got a pathogen, and you got a host response. If neither one of those things are there, you don't have an infection. Okay? Next. What's severe sepsis? Severe sepsis is sepsis plus an organ dysfunction or hypoperfusion or hypotension. The best word is hypoperfusion. We shouldn't get hung up on blood pressures. We need to look at clinical indicators of perfusion at the bedside. We're going to mention what those things are in a minute. Organ dysfunction variables. Here's what we look for in our lab and in our patient to tell us how well the organs are working. How well are the lungs working? We look at AA gradients, alveolar arterial gradients. You and I, right now, as we're sitting and breathing in this room, are breathing 21% oxygen, and our PO2s, if we checked our blood gases, are about 100. That's an arterial over FiO2 ratio of almost 500. You with me? If you see that ratio drop below 300, you better start worrying. There's something that's causing shunt in the lung. You know, whether that's fluid from capillary leak or VQ mismatching from the patient is having respiratory insufficiency, and you need to get worried about them. You need to x-ray them, and you need to figure out what's going on with their lungs because you got to improve that, because if it drops, you will see me talk about terms called acute lung injury and ARDS in a minute, so we won't get ahead of ourselves. Now, I was speaking to a group of nurses. My next question would be to you, what's adequate urine output in your patient? And they are my house staff, interns and residents, and they'd all say 30 cc's an hour. Wrong. If you're not putting out at least half a cc per kilo per hour, your kidneys are not being adequately perfused, they're not adequately functioning. Now, what about my big girlfriend from Tennessee? She weighed 280 pounds, that's 135 kilos. I'm saying a half a cc per kilo for at least 2 hours. She needs to be putting out 70 to 80, almost 100 cc's an hour for me to know that her kidneys are adequately being perfused and working. The other thing I want you to know about the kidneys is they're the most vital organ system that we have to try to preserve as critical care doctors. Otherwise, you die. If we see a rise of creatinine of more than 0.3 in 24 hours, or a serum creatinine on presentation, or at any time during the critical illness of sepsis, septic shock, greater than 2, you are in acute renal failure. Inflammation also affects the coagulation system. How do we look at, we know that it can lead to DIC. What do we look for? What we look for is the PT and the PTT, the INR. And if we see an INR above 1.5, or your partial thromboplastin time greater than 60 seconds, then we better be looking at D-dimers and we better be looking at our platelets, because this patient probably has DIC associated with sepsis. Platelet count, we already mentioned, less than 100,000. We also can develop liver, inadequate blood flow to the liver. How is that manifested? Jaundice. It's called the jaundice of sepsis. If our total bilirubin is above 2.0 milligrams per cent, we need to be worried. Okay, next. There's some, in severe sepsis, there are tissue perfusion variables that we want to look at as well. The best thing we had as far as the information that you folks in the lab gave us were lactic acid levels, okay? If I check the lactic acid level on any of us right now, it should be less than 2, all right? If it's above 4, you're dying. If it's above 4, you're dying. If it's between 2 and 4, you're on your way to dying. It's my job to reverse it with my resuscitation and my goal-directed therapy. How bad is it? If you're just with a lactic acid above 4 alone, your mortality is 60%. The likelihood that you're going to die is 6 out of 10, even if everything else is normal. Next. Then the other things that we need to be looking at is your hemodynamics. Okay, now this is where we're going to actually measure blood pressure. Remember I said you've got to know what the patient's baseline blood pressure is? Here's why it's important. If I see you and your systolic blood pressure is less than 90, you're in big trouble. If your mean arterial pressure is less than 70, you're in trouble. If you have a systolic blood pressure decrease, now I can walk in and I can see a patient with a systolic pressure of 130. Well, most of us would think that's all right. But if you dropped your pressure by 40 over your baseline, say for instance your normal pressure was 170 and you're down at 130, you're in trouble. Okay? Now, let's talk about the most important measurement of pressure in the body. It's mean arterial pressure. Mean arterial pressure. What is mean arterial pressure? Mean arterial pressure is the force of the left ventricle pushing the column of blood flow forward into your aorta and throughout your body. That determines perfusion. What's the two most important vascular beds in the body that have to be perfused for us to live? Your brain. And what's the other one? Your heart. And it takes a mean arterial pressure of at least, we say 70, but you can get by on 60, to adequately perfuse your coronary arteries and your cerebral arteries. Our job is to maintain those pressures with fluid, with calcium, and with vasopressors if necessary, until we eradicate and eliminate infection. Next. So what's severe sepsis? Severe sepsis is sepsis, so it's the inflammatory response plus infection plus organ dysfunction. And that organ, that can be any of the organs that we already talked about. Next. Shock, we've already alluded to, is inadequate tissue perfusion. It's inadequate tissue perfusion due to acute circulatory failure. Now, what do we look like? How do I know a patient's in shock? That is a syndrome that we see at the bedside. And that's a clinical diagnosis. All right, what do I look for from head to toe? This is what I look for. Is the patient awake and alert? That tells me their brain's working. If their mental status is declining or deteriorating or they're confused, your brain's not being adequately perfused. Is your coronary arteries being adequately perfused? If so, your heart rate's going to be less than 90, okay? And I'm not going to see any ischemic changes on your EKG. I'm going to see adequate urine output, which we've already talked about. One of the first things I do when I go up to the bedside is I run my hand under the cover. The nurses think I have a foot fetish, and I'm always feeling my patient's feet. I want to see if they're cool or warm. And then I flip the covers back, and I push on their big toe. If I push on your thumb or big toe, I'll push the blood out of it. It should run back in less than 2 seconds. That's capillary refill, okay? Next. All right, so we've already talked about infection. Now, what are the microorganisms that can cause infection? There they are. You guys know them, all right? But what we're going to be, and the vast majority of the infections that cause sepsis are bacterial or fungal. They can be viral. They can be parasitic. Have we seen them? Yes, but not most commonly bacterial, fungal. All right, we've already talked about MODS, multi-organ dysfunction syndrome. We want to define that for you so you'll see how we tie all this together in approaching a patient. It's an inflammatory mediated injury that occurs when host defenses against the inflammatory response are overwhelmed. This inflammation leads to a chain reaction in the body that overwhelms the body's ability to cope with it. And the pathways you could fill up, you literally, if you had a chalkboard the size of this wall, the pathways wouldn't contain it. Okay? So it's a very complex thing. You also need to understand that you could have multi-organ dysfunction syndrome with anything that causes SIRS. So we can see it not only with infection, we can see it with things other than infection. Next. All right, why is it important for intensivists, for critical care docs, to support organ function? Here it is. The more organs we lose, the happier the undertaker is going to be. All right? We do a pretty good job with one organ system failure. Only 20% of those patients die. But two organs, 40 to 50%. When you have more than three organ system failure, you have an 8 out of 10 chance of failing. If you develop a four-organ system failure, it's pretty much 100%. But now listen to this. The one organ that I fail losing the most, but you know, if we lose the brain, we've lost it all, no matter what. But the one organ I fear the most is the kidneys. Why? If there is no other organ failure alone, and I lose the kidneys to acute kidney failure, I may be able to get you through it, but 95 to 98 out of those percent of those patients die. They die. We just don't do a good job with it. It's paramount that we prevent it. Next. How does multi-organ dysfunction syndrome manifest itself? We already alluded to the lungs, okay? We look at the PaO over FiO2 ratio. We want that preferably above 400. If it drops below 300, that's consistent with acute lung injury. If it drops below 200, then we are developing acute respiratory distress syndrome where we're developing stiff, non-compliant, capillary leak, fluid-filled lungs. It was first described in Vietnam. They called it Da Nang lung. Everybody died. There are maneuvers now, and we'll talk about them very briefly later on, that help us with ARDS. The kidneys, acute tubular necrosis. What happens to your cardiovascular system? It becomes hyperdynamic, and you probably develop hypotension. You become confused or have declining mental status. And if in your central nervous system, in your peripheral nervous system, you can develop a polyneuropathy where you get like a floppy baby and can't move. And that's called the polyneuropathy of critical illness, and that's a diagnosis of exclusion. Your coag system, you can develop DIC. How does it affect your GI tract? Normal peristalsis does not happen. Okay? That's the wave-like motion from your mouth to your anus. That goes on all the time. We just don't feel it. Where does it affect the GI system? Your stomach and your colon. Makes it difficult to feed your patient. These patients have to be fed early on. And let me say this about nutrition, vitally important. We make nutrition rounds 3 times a week in all our ICUs with a nutritional support team. You can, unless a patient has been operated on, you can virtually always feed the patients enterally, because peristalsis, unless you have a small bowel obstruction, always persists in the small intestines. So if we get our feeding tube down through the stomach into the duodenum, jejunum, we're good to go and we rock. Cost, TPN, $1,500 a day. Enteral feeding, $40 a day. Got to do it. The liver, we talked about already. You can see hyperbilirubinemia. The adrenal glands, you can develop acute hypoadrenalism. Just hypoadrenalism. Skeletal muscle, you can get breakdown of skeletal muscle. That's rhabdo. How do we detect that? We look at total CPKs in our patients to make sure that they're not breaking down their own skeletal muscle in amounts large enough to cause rhabdo can lead to ATN as well. Can lead to acute kidney failure. Now, I've already mentioned that these patients hemodynamically will have what's called distributive shock. It's really a maldistribution of the fluids in the body. And what it is a high cardiac output, vasodilatory capillary leak shock. You have increased cardiac output, cardiac index, decreased wedge pressure if you have a Swan in, decreased filling pressures on the right side, decreased CVPs, decreased systemic vascular resistances, you're vasodilated, and you have decreased mixed venous O2 saturations initially. Later on, they may actually be supernormal. Next. All right. There are other things that can cause the systemic inflammatory response other than infection. All right? And here they are. Anaphylactic shock, an allergic reaction can do it to you. Burns, thermal injury can do it. Acute pancreatitis, which we describe as an internal burn, can do it to you. Acute spinal shock, if you have a transection or a spinal cord injury, can do it to you. All right? And then, of course, sepsis. And just remember this, not all SIRS is sepsis, but all sepsis is SIRS. So that'll help you in when you're talking to your clinicians. Not all multi-organ dysfunction syndrome is due to sepsis, but all MODS is due to SIRS. Okay? Now, here's the problem in dealing with patients that are infected in an overwhelming fashion. We have to establish infection as the primary cause. We have to be aware that there are other things that can present a clinical picture that we've already just mentioned that looks like sepsis. We as clinicians must locate the site of infection. Why is that? That's critically important, okay? Because our empiric therapy, our initial empiric therapy, is going to be based on the site of infection and the bugs that we know cause infections in those sites. Okay? Clear as mud? Okay. Now, how do we find that site of infection? History, physical exam, and ordering the right imaging studies, CT, MRI, whatever. We have to have your help in properly interpreting the microbiologic findings. A question our mind always is, especially these patients that come in who are chronically ill, are we looking at true infection, or what are we growing? Is it colonization? Okay, that's the art of medicine. That's why we call it practice. We're trying to get better every day. All right, and we want to identify the cause of illness and the organ dysfunction early, so that we can we monitor it to try to prevent it, and we also want to use it to predict risk and get an idea about the patient's prognosis, because the families are always asking us, Doc, what's mom's chances? What's my wife's chances? And we have to give them an educated guess. Now, how you've seen what an abysmal job that we've done, and during the course of my career, it's really the mortality for sepsis and septic shock really hadn't improved that much. Now, we've improved it in our own institution by strategically going to these bundles, which I'm going to talk to you about in a minute, but how do we improve it nationwide? We go early. We have to detect sepsis earlier on. That means have a higher clinical index of suspicion. How do we do that? We develop a screening tool that makes us think about it. We utilize new biomarkers that are going to help us diagnose infection sooner, much sooner than before. And that's where procalcitonin is going to come in, and you're going to hear me talk about that in a minute. We're going to have to get the quantum leap increase in outcomes based on using bundles. There are two bundles, the resuscitation bundle for sepsis, and that's basically dictated on what's called early goal-directed therapy. And I'm going to tell you what that goal-directed therapy is here in a minute. And then once that occurs during the first 6 hours that we encounter the patient, as part of that, we absolutely as clinicians have to resuscitate the patient and get our antibiotics in them within 4 hours. Okay? Get our anti-infectives in them within 4 hours from the time they hit the ER door or from the time they crash on the floor or from the time that they go bad in the ICU. Now, that's a hard thing to do, but it's akin to from the time they hit the ER door with an acute MI to getting them into the cath lab within 90 minutes and getting that vessel opened up. And we have to treat sepsis and septic shock the same urgency that we treat similar acute medical emergencies to actually improve our outcomes. And then we have to do the management bundle is ongoing after that first 6 hours, and we'll talk about that next. So how do we do it? High clinical index of suspicion, employment of the screening tool. What's the screening tool? There it is. It's very similar to what you've seen before. All right, I'm not going to read it to you. It's in your handout, and these are the things that we look for that tell us we need to intervene on this patient. We need to resuscitate him, and we need to get our cultures, and we need to get our antibiotics in them stat. Next. And, okay, here's the really advance in our ability to diagnose and prognosticate and try to decrease our cost with these patients. And that's better biomarkers and what are the ones we primarily use? Lactic acid, high sensitivity CRP, but an even better indicator turns positive sooner is going to be procalcitonin. So we're going to have to see how it works. Okay, so procalcitonin, we use it to diagnose, we can use it as a marker to diagnose bacterial and fungal infection earlier. It can determine the likelihood for the presence of infection. It helps improve our clinical assessment. It helps us get an idea based on serial measurements of procalcitonin how this patient is going to do. We consider its course. And then maybe later on, as we learn more how to use this biomarker, we may be able to shorten our courses of antibiotic therapy, but that remains to be seen. So what is procalcitonin? It's a propeptide of calcitonin, which is normally produced in the C cells of the thyroid gland. It's a prohormone. It's a precursor to calcitonin. It's 116 amino acids. It has a half-life of about 24 hours. And in healthy individuals, it's produced primarily in the thyroid and in the lungs. In a patient with sepsis, it's produced in virtually every tissue. In the thyroid, in the white cells, in the spleen, the liver is a huge source. Kidneys, adrenals, brain, you can read the list. But it's produced as a marker of inflammation, infection in a wide variety of tissues. Next. It acts as a chemokine, which is basically causes chemotaxis of monocytes, white blood cells, T lymphocytes to attract those cells to the site of infection so you can mount an immune response to try to eradicate and eliminate the infection. It also affects nitric oxide production, and we know nitric oxide production causes vasodilatation in the patient that's septic. It affects other cytokine productions, other mediators. It correlates with the severity of organ dysfunction, and normal levels, and you and I are sitting here right now, are less than 0.05 nanograms per ml. In this slide, you can get an idea, basically, what the levels are in a healthy individual. In an individual with local infections, the levels are really not elevated. They're usually less than 0.5. In a patient that is infected and has mounted and develops sepsis as a response to the infection, those levels start approaching 2 or above. In severe sepsis, they're around 10. And in patients with septic shock, those levels are above 10. These levels rise early on in the course of the infection that is spread body-wide. Now, if you recall in the case presentation, our lady at presentation had a PCT level of 43, so she was significantly elevated. Elevated levels are highly suggestive of bacterial infection with systemic consequences. In septic conditions, your procalcitonin levels can be observed as early as 3 to 6 hours after the infectious agent has challenged your immune system. Okay? These levels are usually low in viral infections and in chronic diseases with chronic inflammatory disorders or autoimmune processes. So they really are fairly specific for bacterial or fungal infections. Next. Procalcitonin development reflects the progression of the disease from sepsis to severe sepsis to septic shock. We've already seen that in a previous slide. And it can potentially have a substantial impact on therapeutic decisions and healthcare costs. So it'll help us know who to give anti-infectives to, hopefully get them to them sooner, and prevent a lot of multi-organ system failure and increase in mortality. If the patient responds to our treatment, we can use PCT to follow response to therapy. Because if we adequately resuscitating the patient and identified the source of infection, and with our empiric anti-infectives have made the right selection, we should begin to see a rapid decrease in the level of procalcitonins as we look at them in the hours and days that follow. Okay? Again, I'm not going to spend any time on this slide. It's in your handout, but it gives you an idea of, based on the clinical condition, what some of the levels of procalcitonin you may expect to see are. How do we use it in the ICU? We use it as a marker of severity of illness and prognosis. Who do we look at it in? Septic patients with uncertain diagnoses. When do we look at it? As soon as possible to detect patients who should receive antibiotics. How do we use it in the ICU? If our clinical assessment is that the patient is developing sepsis and their PCT levels are greater than 0.5 nanograms per ml, they should be treated with antibiotics, with appropriate antibiotics based on site of infection. How will it help us impact? We should be able to make better selection of patients who should receive more aggressive anti-infective therapy and resuscitation therapy. Next. It's a marker for monitoring and tailoring the duration of antibiotics. Now, I say that with the caveat that my practice is, based on the type of infection I'm treating, is I continue to use the IDAS guidelines for whatever that infectious process may be. It remains to be seen, and I think they'll need to do studies to see if we can shorten the duration of anti-infective therapy based on PCT levels. The first measurement is done baseline, and then we monitor the patients for day 3 to day 5 to see if we see a de-escalation in the level of procalcitonins. And then if they return normal or close to baseline, we feel good about stopping our antibiotics at day 7, depending on what the process is. Well, we hope to reduce antibiotic duration therapy, decrease ICU length of stay, and decrease costs. Next. I know the next speaker is an ED physician, and I am not going to steal his thunder. This is in your handout. You can read it. All right? This I've already mentioned. But again, the last bullet down there says, before we use PCT to shorten our duration of antibiotic therapy, we have to weigh that against current clinical guidelines based on the type of infection that you have. Next. Go skip that slide. Okay. Now, how does it work? These guys from Biomeur can tell you better than I can, but it's basically an alpha enzyme-linked fluorescent assay, antigen antibody, and used under the VITAS system. And they're going to be looking at other applications of it as time goes on. And I will defer questions about the lab to them. Okay, next. This is interpretation of the results for the sake of time. I won't go through this. This is the way we use it. You can read this for yourself based on the levels. I've already covered this in the talk. Next. Remember I told you that we can use it to predict prognosis. People that respond, their levels rapidly drop. People that don't, their levels stay elevated and they are not able, those patients don't do well. What's in your handout is the way we employ early goal-directed therapy. Okay? It's in your handout, and it's also the sepsis bundle resuscitation is in your handout. Okay? If you have any questions, we'll be happy to cover that. Now, let's finish the story on our lady, on our obese lady. She got CT of the abdomen. On that CT of the abdomen, we saw diffuse inflammation in the rectosigmoid colon. We had the GI guys come and scope her, and this is what her colon looked like. She had a diffuse colitis. She went ahead to grow out E. coli. They translocated. We felt like she had microvascular disease from longstanding diabetes. She developed an ischemic colon. She developed acute renal failure. Now back up to this is after, I think you can see, this is after, we rescoped her about 10 days later, and you can actually see some pink colon in there now. So you can see some colon where there's blood flow. Next. So we resuscitated her using goal-directed therapy. She was on the ventilator for 10 days. She progressed to septic shock, even though we maintained the CVPs with fluid at 10 to 15. She required IV calcium. She went on a norepinephrine drip for 3 days in addition to her fluids. She progressed to acute renal failure, had to be dialyzed for 10 days. Then she beat the odds, her kidneys recovered, and she made urine on her own. And next slide. We treated her for 14 days. Her PCT levels decreased daily and normalized on day 5. She transferred to the floor on day 15. Let's stop here.